It was rather exciting in a way, but you had to calm other people who were more upset than yourself, and they were really upset. I'm a bit of a fatalist, you know. I just felt, well, if you're going to be hit, you're going to be hit. I guess it just wasn't our time to go. It's as simple as that.
The nurses of No. 14 Canadian General Hospital did eventually reach their destination, the battlefields of Italy.
Of the CBC, speaking from Italy.
Immediately below us, there is a perfect view of a battle. The German shells at the moment are falling on our forward position.
Broadcast correspondents in the Italian campaign got in very close to the fighting, as correspondents still do. Nurse Nora Carlton got in close, too. Close to the men who took those bombs and bullets.
There was one boy that came in, he was only about 18, that had had both his legs blown off, and he was in pretty shock condition. And he got a letter the day after he got there from his mother, saying that she was so relieved he was in Italy, because she knew he'd be comparatively safe in Italy, and here was this poor kid with both his legs blown off.
The most badly wounded were evacuated from Italy to England or to Canada on the hospital ships. Nursing sister Rossi Crowe was on the Lady Nelson.
They were so brave and so good. They were excellent patients and so young. I had two brothers also in the forces, in the army. Fortunately, there's only one of them that was injured at all. But that's what you think about when you see these other people coming in. They think one of them could be your brother. One thing that's always stood out and I've always remembered, we have a young boy come in on a stretcher, take him into my ward, and I take his temperature, and it's 105. And I cannot see one mark on this boy. But his spinal cord had been cut with a piece of shrapnel up in his cervical area, and he was completely paralyzed, and it had affected his heat system. And he just ran a temperature, and he knew that there was a possibility he might not get home to Canada, but his parents wanted him to take this chance, and he did die shortly after we sailed, and he was buried at sea. And that's one thing that I'll never forget, is a burial at sea. It seemed so lonesome. He's there all alone at that time, but, you know, it's only for a minute. And then it's over, but you never forget those things.
Italy was the first foothold on continental Europe since the ill-fated raid on the French coast at Dieppe. Then, on June the 6th, 1944, the Allied forces paid a return visit to France. D-Day.
We are on the beach today, on D-Day. While we have been here, we have just seen one of the strangest and most remarkable sights of this invasion so far. Two great fleets of over 100 gliders have gone overhead, towed by C-47 transports, and the second batch are droning over now. I can see them, they're casting off...
That was a sight I never will forget. The sky, there was the formation, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 planes, and all going over in really remarkable, fine formation. We had waited so long for D-Day, everyone had waited so long, that somehow or other it was hard to believe. But when the casualties came in, you certainly knew.
Back in England at Jesse Middleton's hospital at Taplow, the wounded streamed in straight from the Normandy beaches. After D-Day, many Canadian nurses in England followed the fighting forces right into the war zones. They'd been well prepared back in England.
We did all sorts of things that we'd never done before. We went on long training route marches. We took road mapping. We had to shoot guns. And when the gun went off, it almost break your shoulder. The repercussion was so great. And we had judo practice as self-preservation. We were, you know, nurses and doctors. And I remember throwing this doctor over my head just in practice.
They sent us down to the southern coast to take us over to France. And they put us on these LSDs. Some of the girls were pretty excited. We're going to France. We might get sunk. Look what happened in Dieppe.
We carried a big haversack on our backs, plus a small little haversack with a great tin cup hanging onto it. And we wore our tin hats, and we were in battle dress. And from the rear, I don't suppose you'd know that we were much different from a soldier, except we were wider in the behind.
Ruth Hood. The Allied soldiers advanced through Europe. Right behind came the mobile field dressing stations and CCSs, casualty clearing stations. Doctors and nurses like Matron Evelyn Pepper were often within shelling range.
Being with a mobile unit such as ours, 5CCS, meant that you were capable of and expected to move very quickly and follow the troops. And when once we got to our site, we had to set up and prepare to receive casualties. And we did that so many times. The training we'd learned in England was a godsend. We were reinforced by field dressing stations. Then apart from that, we had three operating room teams of our own working all the time once you got into battle. Often a shrapnel would come through the tent, but nobody suffered any grave casualties. One time in Lanciano, they were in the midst of an operation, and there was a noise up above, and the nurse, she said, oh, there must be mice in the roof. And the doctor said, that's not mice, that's shrapnel.
The kind of physical hardship we had to put up with, I think that that sort of showed in the personality of the person. And although you did pretend that you were tough and ready for anything, I think some of it wore out a bit. Two of our nurses had to be in psychiatric wards in England for quite some time. It was very hard to face at times.
World War II ravaged the spirit as well as the body. Men and women needing psychiatric help, like those two nurses, were sent to special wards in British hospitals. One was in a country estate, Hackwood House, officially the Basingstoke Neurological and Plastic Surgery Hospital. For the casualties, a haven from the nightmare. But for nurses like Joan Leray in the psychiatric wards, the nightmare was all around them.
To see all these really young people sitting, looking dazed, others with their head in their hands, some walking about in an agitated form. I remember this one man was lying on his bed, and every few minutes he would jump up off the bed, stand at the foot of the bed, and stand rigidly at attention until the nurse came by and said, okay, soldier, it's okay, you don't have to stand there like that anymore. You're safe here.
Jesse Chalmers was also at Basingstoke.
These people were, a great many of them, sent home because they realized that they were not capable of work under stress. I mean, a lot of them saw the horrors of war, of things they'd never even imagined.
I was on a night shift, and I heard a patient coughing. So what we would often do is just pour a little cough mixture in a glass and go down and sit and just have a little sip. But by the time I got down to this fellow's bed, he dropped off to sleep. So I turned to go, and there was a little tiny window in the Neeson hut, and the moon was shining through, and all of a sudden, he chopped my hand with his hand, practically paralyzed it, knocked this thing to the floor. He just said he, out of the corner of his eye, he saw something shining in a hand, and his first instinct was to use one of these commando chops on my hand. He thought he was back at the front. This was a particularly different kind of war wound.
Joan Luray worked in the other units at Basingstoke with other tragic cases, the burn patients.
I think the worst was to see people so horribly disfigured and trying to deal with their lives from day to day when they were having great major dressings done, trying to even take some fluids. The other thing was the smell, the stench from 40 burned bodies is hard to imagine. And when you would come to work at the beginning of a shift, it would hit like a blast, this awful smell.
Some men had burns all over their body. Rosamund Watson.
For me, that just sent a sword through your heart. These young men who would arrive, and they weren't recognizable from their face. And in order to do the plastic surgery and restore some semblance of their appearance, they would have to send home for pictures of themselves. The result would depend on how good the photograph was. We had a Dr. McIndoe, an Australian doctor of plastic surgery, and he came down to Basingstoke to lecture to the Canadian doctors, all the nurses too. He was working at East Grinstead. That's where Canadian doctors did a lot of innovative work.
East Grinstead. Most Royal Canadian Air Force personnel went there for plastic surgery or for maxillofacial treatment, rebuilt jaws. They were victims of a recent breakthrough in destructive technology, air warfare.
I'm speaking to you from a bomber station in England. I've just met Canadian crew members of a Halifax. Pilot Officer Rudy Wagner of Edmonton, Alberta, during this trip you made, where was the sortie to?
It was to Hamburg. We went on a bombing raid there, and about 5 minutes off the target when I saw the first enemy night fighter. And as soon as he came within range, I gave him two short bursts, and he immediately burst into flame and dropped down.
My name is Hilda Moore, Niemke. I was in the RCF, and hadn't heard about East Grinstead. But when I got overseas, I was told that I was posted to East Grinstead to a burn unit. Still didn't prepare me, and it was quite a shock. Most of the patients came, had crashed and burnt, and they came to us for reconstructive surgery. Most of them had their noses, eyelids, mouth burnt off, just bare bones and skin. And some of them didn't see their faces until they got out. And one chap found a piece of mirror and looked at himself, and it was horrifying. There was a face that he didn't know. And then our job was not just to heal their wounds, but to take them out, get them out into the town, to the pubs. And we always hung out at the Whitehall. This is the pub. We had our parties there. And the publican was Bill Gardner. And one day these two healthy-looking guys, I think they worked for the government, and they came in and they sat at the stool and looked around. And I said to Bill, how can you stand these people around here? And he looked at them and he took their money, threw it at them. He said, I can stand them fine, but you two get out. It's you I can't stand. And this was the attitude of the whole town. They had no mirrors in the pubs. We had no mirrors in the hospital. And with their faces all burnt, they didn't need to shave. There was a camaraderie with them that was unbelievable. They formed this guinea pig club because of the experimental surgery, as it was then. And this is a tightly knit group.
One guinea pig, RCAF wireless air gunner John Southwell, had reconstructive surgery at East Grinstead after his face was badly lacerated.
At our age, most people were 18, 19, 20, 21. You're very impressionable. And the first thought that comes through your mind is you feel sorry for yourself until you see somebody worse off than you. Then you realize, I'm not so bad after all. And basically that was the credo the guinea pigs lived by. I guess I can't say enough about the nurses. At no time did they baby us. At no time. As a matter of fact, they sometimes would say a derogatory remark back to us if we got smart with them.
We try to make them feel normal, and it's pretty hard when you see these poor people. First day I walked in, I said to this chap, hello. He said, hello, what's your name? And I said, Nursing Sister M.K. And he said, what's your first name? And I said, well, later when we get to know you better. And I turned to go, and he'd had his fingers cut off just at the first knuckle, because they're burnt. And he pinched me, and it was just like visors. And I turned around and I said, you do that again, I'll punch you in the nose. He said, ha, 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 I haven't got one. He didn't have one. I felt terrible. But this is their sense of humor. Oh, I haven't got one.
They were tough with kindness. Very tough and very, very kind. They would do anything for you. And this included all the staff, not only the nursing sisters. Everyone is very, very kind, and everything they did was done with great, great professionalism. So I really can't say enough. They were that good to us.
In spite of all the kindness and professional care of medical staffs everywhere, the war drove some patients beyond all help. Eva Wannup, a nurse in the plastic surgery unit at Basingstoke.
One morning, the night nurse came off and she said, oh, we have a patient who's horrible. He looks horrible and he's horrible. He swears and you just can't do anything with him. So I found this young soldier who had been burned, severely burned, and his face and hands were just like skeletons, practically all the flesh gone. There was no earlobes, no eyelashes, no nose. His mouth couldn't close it. So we put him into the baths, and he would be swearing. And I could understand, because here was a young man that was good-looking and full of life, and now here he was, his whole life was ruined. So we found that these patients, it was just as important to help them mentally as well as it was physically. So some nights he used to come in about 3 o'clock in the morning and sit and talk, and told me about his girlfriend. I think he was engaged, and that engagement was off. And then after time, they started the grafting, and this would take a period over about 2 to 2.5 years. I think some think of plastic surgery at maybe 1 or 2 operations and you're fine, but it's 30 or more operations. I don't know how many, you know, to do this. They tried to form the face, and they had a picture of him. But when he came back to Canada, when he'd go out in public, it bothered him to see people staring at him, and he got into some fights and eventually committed suicide.
Well, I think the terrible part is that everybody loses somebody from death or damage. And, oh, I'm going to cry. The one I think of the most ended up with brain damage and ended up a permanent patient. But that was common. And everybody in the hospital had either a relative or a close friend who was either seriously wounded or killed.
One of our nursing sisters, who had been overseas for quite some time and seen her brother occasionally, he was with the tank corps. And I thought it was the saddest thing that could have happened. He was killed the day before the war ended. We found it hard to really accept that the war was over, because we still had all these sick patients around us. We were still in it, and we'd been in it for so long, it was hard to look ahead.
A sense of war on ideas. The program was prepared and produced by Doug MacDonald. We'd like to thank the nurses we heard tonight, and those we didn't because of time constraints. Also the people who helped us in preparing the program. Margaret Alamang, Beatrice Marshall, and others in the Victoria branch of the Nursing Sisters Association of Canada. Bill McNeil, Ben Haffey, Whitney Richardson, and Ken Pewley of CBC Radio Archives. Technical operations were by Lorne Tulk and Roman Zayombra, sound effects John Stewart, and our production assistant was Gail Brownell. You can get a transcript of tonight's program. Send $5, check or money order, to Ideas Transcripts, A Sense of War, Box 500, Station A, Toronto M5W1E6. And please be prepared to wait for up to 8 weeks for delivery. That's Ideas Transcripts, A Sense of War, Box 500, Station A, Toronto M5W1E6. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Lister Sinclair. Good night.